Welcome everyone to the Off Track Podcast. Thank you for pulling a chair up to the table. I am your host as always, Matt Eschy, and it is great to have you here. This week, a fellow Wisconsinite, one of the greatest distance runners the United States has ever seen, and currently the cross-country coach and assistant track and field coach, still coaching the distance runners at the University of Florida, Chris Zielinski, jumps in an airboat, jets across the swamp, and pulls a chair up to the table. It was great to have him make the trek all the way over here. But take a listen as Chris discusses the drive and determination it took to reach the heights he did as a runner, the lessons he learned from those failures, and the way he has taken the successes and failures to help teach his athletes to become an all-around better athlete. Let's get ready to make some podcast magic with the one and only Chris Zielinski. Hi, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us here at the Off Track Podcast tonight, episode number 33. We have an incredible guest, the distance coach and the assistant track and field coach at the University of Florida, probably one of the greatest distance runners that America has ever seen, actually in the state of Wisconsin has ever seen, joining us tonight, Mr. Chris Zielinski. But before we get to Chris, let's turn around and meet the panel as always. You never know who shows up or who's got what going on. But first and foremost, we got Mr. Darren Flowers down there. Look like he's bundled up in the Rio Grande Valley. You warm or are you freezing?
The temperature's right. So it's weird here. You know, the temperature's a little bipolar. So it's pretty warm during the day when I was out at the track. And then, you know, the temperature just plummets. And plus it's freezing in my house. So really it's because it's in my house. I'm wearing a jacket. I've gotten really soft. I'll just say that.
You have definitely gotten soft. My goodness, dude. Come on, knock it off. We've got Scott Williamson out at Nevada. He's hobbling his way around the house right now. Scott, how you doing, buddy?
I'm doing pretty good. We had a big storm last week. Got everything covered with snow. So hopefully that decays all the goose shit we had on our high jump apron. And by the time the snow's gone, hopefully the goose shit's gone as well. So
you're legitimately going to have some petrified shit on there.
I probably will, yeah.
There's no question about that. We've got... he was probably the one that helped start everything down at SLU and, you know, helped SLU pull a lot of basketball games and get everybody pissed off at him. But Mr. John Bell, how we doing, John?
I'm doing well. I had nothing to do with that. I was there. I enjoyed the Twitter drama. It was great. But I will give our administration kudos for making a smart decision. They handled that situation really well. And so, you know, owe them some credit, but super excited. Kids are back. We've had a couple days of practice. So cross country meet on Saturday, high of 25 in Charleston, Illinois. So cross country, here we come.
It's going to be brilliant. At least you guys will be able to race cross country. Historic. I don't know how they're going to put this down in the record books, but cross country in the winter, this is going to be a lot of fun to see.
Hey, it's what the Europeans do, right?
I know. America's not used to it.
Hey, I've got a couple Europeans on my team. So they're like, hey, this is normal.
Trust me, I still would think the more I've thought about it, I think we should go to cross country in the winter. I think it'd be fun. Screw the indoor season. Let's just go straight to cross. But we'll see what.
Especially
does.
If you live in the South, right, Chris?
Perfect. Perfect cross country weather at FSU on Friday.
Hello. We've got a gentleman who decided, you know, his books weren't enough. He went out and bought a globe for us, put that back up on his shelves a little bit. Mr. Mike Gerb, how you doing over there in Bloomington, buddy?
Good. I'm good. Like I said, we had a little bit of snow also. It's been kind of strange, but we're getting a little better now. And so, yeah, we're just excited to get rolling.
How many inches did you shovel last week?
Like 6 inches. It was crazy. I mean, that was it doesn't compare to the year that I spent in Milwaukee, where it was, yep. I think, the second snowiest winter in the history of Milwaukee, the year that I lived there. And I remember I'd shovel 2-3 times a day. Mm-hmm. You get up in the morning, clear your sidewalk, come home after work, clear it again. And then before you go to bed, you got to clear it again. It was a mess. So at least it's not like that.
Yeah. My dad called me up. He goes, he's like, well, how you doing down there? I'm like, well, it's, you know, 55 degrees for us. It's a little chilly, but not bad at all. He's like, oh, I was just started shoveling, got about 8 inches in and then realized my snowblower broke. I'm like, what are you going to do? He's like, well, time to go back inside and get a beer. I was like, just go pay the local kid $30. He'll probably get it done for you in a couple of hours. And then, of course, we've got Mr. Tom Sage, jumps multis, gentleman of VCU. And also, he pretends to coach the hurdles as well. I think it's more production value with the videos he puts out there on Twitter. But no, actually, he does an incredible job of the hurdles. Tom, how you doing, buddy?
Doing well. We also got a little bit of snow this week, but it's all gone now. So no problems.
Okay, so you got a clear track, no petrified stuff.
Nope. I was out there today. 32 degrees, but
it was a little chilly here in Birmingham today. I mean, this morning we had practice, it was 25, but it got up to 53, so I'm not going to complain too much.
I had to wear a sweatshirt and a vest. It was brutal.
Did you really? And of course, we got Chris Selinsky here in the podcast. He's sitting there, you know, the former Spash kid sitting down in Gainesville, Florida. There is no snow on the ground at all. He's bundled up, you know, like it was 15 below. But Chris, how you doing? Thanks for joining us.
Hey, happy to be here and looking forward to kind of discussing all things track and cross country and how the world turns.
Man, and you're going to Florida State this weekend, you said?
We are. We're taking both our men and women to Florida State and trying to apply the lessons that we learned from the fall and see if we can turn a chapter in the distance program here.
Yeah, that'd be good. That's going to be a fun little meet. That's going to be a hell of a meet. No questions about it. I love what Brayman's doing down there. And speaking of meets, one thing I think we need to talk about right away off the bat, second one they've had, they've got a third one. I don't know if they're going up against the Super Bowl, because honestly, I don't know what time the Super Bowl is. I just flip it on and hope it's on. But the American Track League had their second meet on Sunday down at the University of Arkansas. The first one I think a lot of people saw was a bit of a production shit show. And if you actually read into it, talk to some people about it, they only had, I think, they're supposed to have a full production crew, and only three or four people ended up showing up. They had some guys running left and right, running four or five different cameras, trying to get things going. I talked to some people, and they said that's why Brian was kind of in the stands, and the interviews weren't good, and everything wasn't crisp. But did you guys watch the second one, or watch either of them with these things? I think this is actually really good for the sport, and Chris, being a former pro athlete, like something that you probably would have enjoyed back in the day.
Yeah, I personally didn't see the second one, but I watched the first one actually from a hunting blind. I thought they did a solid job. Obviously, there was some glitches, but I mean, it's tough to put on a production of a show. Like I, for a little while, tried to put my hat in the ring of announcing, and that's not an easy task. And you know, if ESPN's involved, they're gonna clean it up. And from what I've heard, and I can only imagine that. Yeah, it's going to be each time they do it, it's going to be a cleaner and cleaner show. But as an athlete, like, you're just looking for an opportunity to compete, especially, you know, this day and age. And the mantra of have meat will travel, I think, shows like the performances are still there. And it doesn't necessarily matter. We're going to be the biggest critiques because we want our sport to be presented in the best way possible. So obviously we're going to be picky, but I don't know about you guys, but anytime track's on TV, I'm trying to tune in.
Yeah, I didn't get to see this last one, but the first one, I mean, I was just starved for track and field. So, you know, there were some glitches. And, you know, kind of what I heard, that there was a major glitch right before they went live on TV with some, you know, power production or, you know, I don't know. It's above my head. I don't know that stuff. But they actually had a major glitch, you know, unexpected right before they went live. So, you know, kudos to them for getting it done. And again, hey, first event out is a world record. That's cool. Awesome. Cool. I mean, that's awesome. So, and I thought, again, I was starved for track and field. So I'll go back and watch this last one, but I thought it was great.
It was great. And the second one was certainly much improved. And having heard a little bit of the issues that they had that were sort of out of their control for the first one, it certainly took the edge off what we saw. You know what I mean? It was a little rough, but at the same time, we were watching track and field, which was really cool. And the second time was, I thought, lights out. I mean, it was exactly what you would have expected, not just from the production side of things, but from the performance side of things. And it was really enjoyable to watch and was clearly a much smoother operation. But it was great. And clearly, we're just lacking opportunities, because certainly we had some just phenomenal performances when given those opportunities here at home. You know, like you said, you see a world record out of the gate, you watch the second fastest American 800 meter time in the all time. You know, so there's just some really incredible things happening. We just need an opportunity to go out there and do it. And it's great to see the athletes taking advantage of what limited opportunities they have and really putting on a show. So it was a lot of fun.
You know, one of the things that, you know, kind of stood out to me was, you know, here was a 2-hour segment of time, and they fit, you know, all the events that they did. It wasn't a full track meet. They didn't have, you know, everything there, but it was entertaining. You know, you got to see some great competition. I mean, world record. I mean, that's pretty amazing anytime you get to see something like that. But, you know, you know, expecting a 8-hour day to watch track and field. You got a good, you know, 2 hours, and you know, that was great. So I hope they kind of keep that format going and just kind of keep improving on it.
I think one of the things we tell our student athletes all the time is to fail and fail fast. And, you know, I think you saw that with the first one and the improvements that were made on the second one, and just kind of following along on Twitter, seeing some of the things that people were saying that could still be improved. I'm sure, you know, by the time we continue doing this, when it's all said and done, it's going to be vastly different from the first one to the last one.
You know, and also, you know, we talked about Ryan Krauser's or mentioned his world record, but can't forget Trayvon Bromell also put down quite the 60 meters, as well. So, you don't want to forget that. That was quite the performance as well. So again, you know, given the COVID situation that we've been in for now, 11 months now, to have world record performances. And I think Trayvon's time was top 20 all time, in the 60 meters. So, I mean, that's, it's kudos to those athletes for really training and in really difficult times. So I think that was awesome.
Can't forget our boy, Grant, tying his American record.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Grant Holloway. Yeah.
Sorry, Grant.
And that's actually like, to forget about something like that, right? Yeah. It's like, that's how high quality this, people can complain about the production value, but the fact that the meet was that high quality that you, oh yeah, we forgot about, yeah, a tied American record. Yeah, pretty good.
Well, I think we're seeing, this is going to sound silly, but like I watched Cars 3 with my kids the other day. And one of the lines that was in Cars 3 was, you have a fear of failure, get rid of the fear of failure and fear not having a chance. And I think that's what we're seeing across the board with all of these, whether it's cross country, indoor, collegiate level, indoor, and now at the professional, even the meets we had this summer, people are kind of saying, well, I don't know if I'm going to have another chance or when I'm going to have another chance. So that fear of failure, it's like inherently kind of getting rid of it, which I think is great for performances. And it's certainly one of the things I'm preaching to the kids I work with is like, who knows when we have another chance. And it's easy to think, oh, I'll get it next time. I'm going to play it safe here and save face. But why are we doing that when it could be, the carpet could be ripped out from under us at any moment?
Chris, I think that's a great point. We have a cross country meet this weekend, and just at practice the other day, I had some kids talking about, well, should we maybe take this weekend off and prepare for, you know, for a meet a little bit later down the road? I said, guys, you're not guaranteed that meet. I mean, we could have a COVID outbreak. They could have a COVID outbreak. Who knows what the scenario might be, but you're not guaranteed that opportunity. So you have one this weekend. You better take advantage of that opportunity.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I've been kind of preaching the same thing to, you know, some of my athletes and stuff. It's like nothing at this point is guaranteed. It could be shut down at any moment. So if you're ready, you better take advantage of it.
And that was one of the biggest thing, a question we had. I think when we originally started I don't know how many episodes ago we went with this, but when, where they had the 4x1500 meter world record, why am I dropping the Bowerman Track Club was doing all that great stuff and the great distance running that was going on out there. And we're like, my biggest question was, is anybody in the track and field world going to do it? Assuming not at the track and field world, but the sprints and the jumps and the throws and all that stuff. Cause we saw some really good pole vaulting with Mondo and his group, and doing some great pole vaulting overseas. We saw some different performances here and there. And all of a sudden it's like, oh, here's a good throw here. And to see all this under one ring shows that, man, track and field athletes, John, you said it, we're starving. We as fans are starving to watch track and field, but the athletes are, you know, starving for the competition as well. I mean, have meet, will compete is 100% exciting about it. And I love how they're doing it. I think it's fun. I think it's exciting. I think the only thing better would be to put 5,000 fans in the stands, which we know isn't going to happen.
not yet. But I do kind of a question for Chris and kind of thinking about this. You know, obviously, you know, the marathon project a couple of weeks ago was phenomenal for you know, American marathoners. You know, unfortunately, the American Track League, and I don't disagree with their decision to really stick to field events and some, you know, short sprints, middle distance stuff. But what are distance runners going to do? You know, what opportunities? I mean, I'd like to see something for our, you know, 5,000, 10,000 meter, you know, types and you know, steeple folks. And, you know, do we feel like those athletes are in the same position that they're ready to pop off if given the opportunity, given the right scenario?
Hey,
it's tough because, you know, we do have a trials coming up and, you know, it's because the length of the training cycles are so much longer and so much more in depth. You know, Bowerman Track Club did some great things over the summer, but kind of let's see some distance runners pop off too.
And I think we will. I really do. I think it'll probably it'll be end of February, beginning of March, once we start seeing people kind of come out of their closets a little bit. But like, obviously, you know, one of the big ones right now is Bowerman Track Club, and you know, Schumacher was my coach for the longest time, and this is like his teenage wet dream of we hardly race, and I'm going to control every variable of every race. So like for him, like, it's going to be very few and far between, but they're going to be controlled efforts, but you better believe they're going to be big efforts. And so like, this is everything he could hope and dream for. And I think a lot of other, we've seen that, right? Like that Sunset Tour and things like that. Like, I think people are just going to create the opportunities. And I think there's one down in Texas coming up.
Let's change the world.
It's, I want to say it's middle or end of February. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. It is coming up. Yeah, it's coming up. They're doing like a little get together, and they're going to go for some standards.
Yeah, I have a feeling we're going to see some impressive things from that. Obviously, it's going to be the start of something special, but I have a feeling we'll see some impressive marks there. And if anything, like, as bad as this last 10 or 11 months has been, it's forced us to be really creative with thinking outside of our norm and just being lazy and being like, okay, you know, here's the Peyton Jordan, here's the Stanford, here's the Raleigh relays, here's the Penn relays, mm-hmm. you know, here's the Drake relays. Like, all right, these aren't there. How are we going to make things happen to get things done that we want to get done and need to get done? And it starts out word of mouth, but I think it turns into a big waterfall eventually, where you get enough people hearing about it, like, hey, I want in on that. And then it becomes something pretty special versus, okay, we're going to plan on this. And all right, that doesn't work for our schedule. We're going to plan on this. And we might see more and more high quality people coming together.
I think one of the nice things as well is, you know, there's only two of these. And so it's a small series just starting up. And I know, again, we got the Pro Track series that'll be starting up for outdoors as well. But the one thing I liked is, and maybe because Twitter didn't get in today's world, maybe Twitter didn't get a hold of it, but we didn't see anybody back out. You know, we didn't see anybody pull out because of an injury. And how many times have we seen sprinters go over in the years? But sprinters go at it in the years, and all of a sudden somebody pulls out, or when a distance guy isn't perfect, or that kind of stuff. And, you know, back and forth. And honestly, Chris, you read the race about your incredible 10K back at Stanford, and that was a back and forth where Rupp was going to go one way, he wasn't going to go the other way, back and forth. And what is he going to do with all that stuff? And it's like, this one, we just saw people get to the line and say, let's go. I mean, we saw a veteran, Chris Selinsky, get after, you know, by the way, the Wisconsin boy, number six all time, got to give him a little bit of props right there in the 800. But I mean, we saw a lot of guys get after it. That's the one thing I'm excited about, because I'm worried about track and field athletes sitting back going, things aren't perfect. Things aren't perfect. F it, I'm out. Go race. We need you guys just to show up and race. But
we lose that a lot because of needing to be perfect, because we need to chase standards. And if all you're worrying about is get your job done and showing up and having an opportunity, then everything else can fall on the wayside.
Yeah. And actually, one other thing, I got to bring up some kudos here. I think I thought, and one thing we've always talked about is we've tried to do some good on this podcast. We try to make people think a little bit on this podcast, and hopefully we are. And again, we appreciate everybody's listenership and listenership and support and sharing the episodes. But the one thing I thought was awesome, and I think everybody kind of misses this. I don't know. You guys saw the Ben Blankenship Women's Mile. Okay. That was awesome. I don't know. And again, I had never asked Paul. I never heard about it, how much it was. I don't need to know how much it was. I don't care. I love the fact that the guy turned around, ponied up for the winner of the women's mile. I thought that was awesome. It's like putting the money where the mouth is. And I was like, that was something special. I know the ATL is just trying to get this thing going. And so having some prize money on the side may or may not be tough, depending what else they're doing. I thought what Ben did was great. I don't know if we're going to see other people do this. I don't know what you guys think, but like, this is a pretty cool thing to be able to have somebody, a pro runner, just pop up and say, here's money.
let's go ahead and win this thing. And the race is pretty good. What, 425, 426, something like that for the winner, if I'm not mistaken. But that's a pretty impressive thing. And actually, from Ben, as you said, you know, it's easy to sit on the sidelines and criticize as much as he does, but it's either be part of the solution or keep it pushing.
I thought, you know, these are professional athletes. I think it'd be great if all the events had, you know, I think that would add, an element to people watching it, like who's going to win the money, you know, or, you know, it'd be great if, you know, all the events had a sponsorship and, you know, the winner took a prize.
Well, I mean, I think, and we could ask Chris, I mean, any race you ran, you know, if there was, you know, a special prize for winning the race, you're going to show up and give your best effort, especially if it's a significant financial, you know, payday, you're going to put the effort out. Nothing speaks louder than money, right?
I was a little different than most, actually. The money was always a byproduct of me just wanting to kick everybody's butt. Sure, it's nice little cherry on top of a good performance. But there are certainly a lot of people out there that seek out prize money and choose their races based on what the purse is. And yeah, I think it's great to have somebody like Ben. He's always been a man of action and stand behind what he says. So not surprised that he did this. I think he's the first of many, and to me, it sounds like there was at least a little inkling of foreshadowing that Off Track might be an event sponsor coming up.
That was a good little thing. You never know what we got.
That's what I'm talking about right there. That's what I'm talking about.
You never know. I'm not supposed to open up those cans a little bit. You know, I appreciate that one, though. I'm going to throw it right back at you here. I think we do this a little bit. But, Chris, a little background for everybody. And I think one thing you mentioned, running for Jerry. Professionally, of course, but you go from Spash, Stevens Point area senior high school up in Wisconsin, and then you head over to the University of Wisconsin, run for the Badgers and throw the W up. So how do you go from, help out some people that may not know, and you know, we're very fortunate to have you on here. What was your biggest challenges to, not true challenges, but you had the challenge from going from, you know, Wisconsin, from Spash to Wisconsin, and then Wisconsin to the pro life?
Yeah, I mean, I think, I was actually just talking to Coach Peterson, our jumps coach, about this because we were just kind of trying to figure out how to get our kids to understand that like success isn't instant and it's a process of learning, but having that confidence and being able to stand behind that confidence of like, I know I'm going to figure it out. It's not a matter of if, it's a when. And I've always been a person, I'm going to meet a challenge head on and I'm going to beat my head against the wall until I figure it out. And that's whether I'm competing against somebody or trying to figure out a level of competition. There was never a give up button. And you know, my father instilled that in me. Like if you're going to do something, you do it 110%. Like you don't back down until you've got nothing left and you're lying there wrung out on the floor. And so, Matt, you and I had some nice battles in high school. And I think that, for me, it was like the first step and first sign of like, okay, I'm not going to back down to anyone and I'm going to figure out how to beat these guys. You were a very intimidating force, when I was starting out in high school. And so for me to
appreciate that,
figure out how to best take down the defending champ and the guy who's kicking everybody's butt was difficult, but you know what? Like literally every day I visualized it. Like from the moment I finished my freshman year of high school, I was visualizing, okay, what do I have to do to beat Matt Eshin? Mm-hmm. And that's what I was thinking about on runs. And then I used that lesson and that skill to be like, okay, how am I now trying to beat the best high schoolers in the country? And then, you know, transitioning from high school to college is like, okay, how do I figure out this level? And it would start, like, I literally just visualized. And when I was out running, visualized what I was doing, thinking about it. But the key, and this is what I tell the kids I work with a lot, like, you can't obsess. Like, when I was training, I was all in visualizing. When I wasn't training, I was a normal kid, doing what normal kids do and forgetting about the whole running thing. But when I was in it, I was locked in and it wasn't just going through the motions. Like everything had a purpose. You know, I had some opportunities and things that fell definitely in my way, that maybe there's a decision split second. Like I still replay in my mind the cross country meet, was it 2000? 2000. Yeah,
2000.
Like there was a couple moments in there, like it could have, like I still like, man, if I, cause I was 10 meters away from falling short, like literally like falling before I hit the finish line. And I was like, man, if that, like, what if I would have pushed sooner and had nothing left? And like, it's just, you think about it, it's like little minute things that can go one way or the other. And those, you just have to feel fortunate they fall in your favor.
Yep.
But it, a lot of it has to come with instinct as well. And, but it's like, it's that visualization of like, I didn't visualize that I was going to fall short. I didn't visualize that, you know, the plan wouldn't work, and didn't visualize that I wouldn't be where I wanted to be. And like, sure, there was times it didn't work my way, but there was definitely times it did. And I think, you know, even talking further on in the career of like running under 27 minutes, yep. Literally the start of that fall, starting at the end of 2009, literally I would tell myself, and then think about how I was going to do it for like 15 minutes of my run. Like, I'm going to break an American record. In my mind, it was the 5K. I never once thought about the 10K, but like every run I went on, I told myself I'm breaking an American record. And I got to the point where I believed it. Like, I believed it so much that it started then coming to fruition in training. And then that reinforced it even more. So then anytime, like when I got to the point where I was in races and had the chance to do it, like, I was like, yeah, of course I am. Of course I should be here, and of course I should be doing this because I've been preparing for this constantly. So sorry, I strayed, but I couldn't.
So I want to piggyback off that. Were there points where you ever had doubt? And if you did, how did you overcome it?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Constant doubt. if you ever saw me before a race and I was quiet and keeping to myself, it was me battling the doubt. You know, I saw a quote from Laird Hamilton, the world, you know, one of the world's best surfers, and it was you know, your mind is a television screen. You're the only person that owns a remote control. And for whatever reason, that spoke volumes to me of like, yeah, these are thoughts. They're negative and false thoughts. And so my job is to just turn the channel. And it's that easy of like, yeah, this is BS. I'm not going to believe this. And for each person, it's different how you turn that channel. Like for me, it would be, you know, looking back at my training log or thinking back about workouts as to like, maybe I struggled, but I got through it. Like, okay, getting confidence from that, or maybe I crushed it. And this is why I should be able to run with these people, or this is why I should be able to be going after these times. But, you know, the kids I coach, like I harp to till I'm blue in the face about keep the importance of a training log. And they're just like, why do we need to do this? I'm like, it's for you and it's for me. But like, you should be looking back on this constantly. And I want you to write in like how you're feeling, how the workout went, like things you learned, because writing that down, one, it locks everything in just a little bit more up here, but you can go back and read and be like, that's right. Like those really hard workouts, when you get through them, they actually, like when you think back on it, you're like, yeah, I crushed that workout. But you know how many times I had workouts that I remember now that I crushed that I go back and look, I was like, man, I didn't think I was going to finish that workout. And it just puts in the reality of like, yeah, there's so many times that it didn't go easy. So when you start struggling in a race or workouts down the road, that it shouldn't be easy and it should be a struggle and there should be something that you overcome. You know, listening though to your guys' podcast last week with Walt, like there should be resistance. Like there should be, you grow through that resistance. And I that spoke to me 100%.
You have to expect some sort of failures, or, you know, cause it's not failures. I mean, but failures are going to happen, but it's self-doubt as well. And I'm not gonna lie. We'll go back to that 2000 race. I didn't expect to see you at all. I had no idea whatsoever. and a true story here, and I'll bring it up. An incredible, incredible gentleman by the name of Rick Witt called me on Monday or Tuesday that week and said, hey, you might want to watch out for this Selinsky kid up here in Stevens Point. And I was like, and Coach Witt had coached my high school coach. So, I mean, to hear from Witt wasn't anything out of the ordinary for me. And I was like, who the hell is this Selinsky kid? And then all of a sudden, as we got rocking and rolling, you know, what were we, about 2 miles into the race, 2.5 miles of the race up the hill, all of a sudden it was like, oh shit, this kid's right here. And that was a grind to the end of it. No questions about that. And you're right. I thought I saw you stumble a little bit finishing up the last bit. I'm like, oh, please fall, please fall. Oh, come on. I'm sorry to bring up the end of that race, but I remember it. And I was like, I still was baffled by it, by the end of it, but I just got that day. I just got out gut, and that was the way it was. And there was no self-doubt, but it was just, I didn't prepare for the unexpected. And I think that's something we don't do. We expect things to go perfectly every single time. We expect the races to be perfect. Like, oh, I know exactly what my splits are going to be for the 5K if I'm going after the American record, or what I'm going to go after, you know, for this race or that race. And then you realize, oh, I was supposed to go through in 421. And you're like, oh, I'm through in 424. I'm way off. And then things just spiral out of control. Like, no, you might actually still be on. You're not, on, but you're like, hey, you can come back from this. You're still fine. You're right in there. So it happens a lot. What was your biggest?
Yeah, I don't think I saw you until about a mile and a half, 2 miles. Mm-hmm. You were gone.
Yeah. I had a viral infection that week as well, too. I think Witt kind of freaked me out a little bit. And I was like, what?
Here come the excuses.
No, that one was 100% true. They actually kept me away from the course on Friday, believe it or not. I wasn't even allowed at the course. My coaches were like, you go play video games. We're going to go take you to the course. And I was like, oh, crap. Dang. But it was what it was.
Well, and, see, again, like I said, I got lucky, things fell in my way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You getting sick, and my first national title in track was in college was, I mean, Tegan Camp should have won that hands down day in, day out, but he got a cold and it knocked him down, and he made a big move like he always did. I just followed him like I always did. And all of a sudden it was either 300 or 500 to go. All of a sudden I see his hand come down and wave me past. I'm like, the heck are you doing? It's like, okay. Luckily his move, we got a big gap and paid off, because I got kicked down, but I had enough of a gap because of his move that got my first title. Fell right into it. Shouldn't have won it. Finished third at the Big Ten meet, but I'll take it.
But again, you just had to believe in yourself. You had to believe that this was going to happen. Like, I can do this. It may present itself. It may not. But if it can, I've got to be ready for it. And then you've got to kick it and rock it and roll. And those are some of the most, you know, those are sometimes more memorable races than the races that you were favored to do well, right?
I say it till I'm blue in my face to every kid that I coach. Like, give yourself a chance to surprise yourself. Put yourself in a position and give yourself that chance to win. You may not do it. You may lose 9 times out of 10. But you better be in the right place and be prepared for that 1 time out of 10. And it takes just that kind of dumb confidence, I guess, that you just believe that, okay, even if it goes bad, like to be honest, like taking camp, bringing him up again, like he and I had like this eternal philosophical debate constantly. I was the guy that always stuck my nose in it. He was the guy that always started out controlled, worked through the field, and like divvied up his energy the right way. 9 times out of 10, he came past me at the end of the race because I overdid it and I came backwards. And I still remember it to this day. It was a race in Gateshead, England. And it was a 3K with Bekele, Legat, Mottram. I forget who else was in it. Those three were the main title. Mo Farah was in it, and Tegan Camp and Alistair Craig. And Bekele called the pace of 4:58 through 2K. And the weather was awful. It was like 15 or so mile an hour winds. It was raining, so like the rain was like sideways. And before the race, I even said, I'm like, I'm going with it. And Matt was like, are you crazy? Why would you, like, you can't do that. I'm like, we'll see. I'm gonna give it a shot. And like, I hung with it until about 2200 meters or so, and then the wheels came off. And I still remember Tegan Camp and Mo and Alistair kicking past me in the last 100 meters, and I actually pissed blood after that race. It was bad. And afterwards, Matt's like, will you finally like stop being stupid and just freaking run the right race and like stop trying to think you can run with the best in the world? I'm like, Matt, the way I look at it, like, I can't run with them yet, but I'm getting over the fear when I can run with them that I'm not gonna be afraid of anything they throw at me. And a couple of years later, I was finally got to the point where I was fit enough to be able to run with them. But I was like, the worst thing that's gonna happen is I die. Like, okay, it hurts, but like, why would I, why, like, I'm not going to, if I want to be the best in the world, why am I letting the best in the world run away from me? And, you know, I never got to the full fruition of like what my ultimate goals were of being in the best in the world, but like, shoot, got pretty dang close. And that's what I try to tell the kids I coach is like, it doesn't have to be the best in the world, but like, give yourself that chance to surprise yourself. And it takes very much risking failure. And you may fail more times than you succeed, but we learn from those failures. And you conquer the fear when, because it's a when, not if, we get to the point where we can handle that type of pace or that type of race atmosphere or that level of competition. It's not an if, it's definitely a when. And fear is, as you can tell, theme of everything I do is like, you can't be afraid. Like being afraid is always going to be our limiter.
You know, I don't know, Chris, I 100% agree with that kind of thought process, you know, with especially, you know, that race in England. You know, really, what were the expectations? I mean, I'm trying to, obviously, I've never been in that situation, but, you know, if I'm sitting there looking at like the world's best, really, what's the what do you have to lose by trying at that point? I mean, did anybody really have the expectation that you were going to beat all those guys? I mean, you probably, if somebody said to you before the gun went off, hey, you're going to win this race, you would have looked at them like they were absolutely crazy, right? Mm-hmm. So, but why not try? Like, what do you have to lose? And sometimes I think, you know, as coaches, we sometimes overcomplicate what something. You know, I think it was what Steve Magnus maybe tweeted this, or somebody tweeted it recently. Like, good coaches simplify really complex things, and bad coaches, you know, do the opposite, basically. You know, but why not just go out there and try and compete and see what happens? Like, you know, the worst in that scenario was you were going to get beat. That's the worst thing that was going to happen. And well, before the race even started, you probably knew you were going to get beat. But
yeah, but
if you throw your hat in the ring and see what happens.
Exactly. I was that guy who was dumb enough to believe that I could. and it was a race a few years before that. I overcame a fear of people. So like I gave everyone a lot of respect. Like I'm a track geek, like through and through. Like I was that guy, Tekken Camp always make fun of me. I was like, that's so-and-so and they've done this and this. That's so-and-so and they've done this and this. Like I knew everyone and everything they did to the hundredth of a second, all their major stats. And it was Michele again and Matram actually, and doing strides before the race. And I don't know if I wasn't paying attention or if he wasn't paying attention, but I almost ran Michele right over, like just crushed him before the race. And like, he said something to me and I don't remember what he said, but I remember hearing his voice and it was higher pitched than I thought it would be. And I was just like, why am I scared of him? Like, like I could have just killed him. Why am I afraid of him? And if, for whatever reason, I was like, he's just a person just like I am. I'm sure he's got nerves just like I do. Like, why is it that I'm giving him this holier than thou? Like, he's human. He could have bad races. And to be honest, like Alistair Craig, it was, I'm trying to remember the year. I want to say it was like 2005 or six when Michele miscounted laps, Alistair Craig beat him in indoor 3K. And for me, that was like one of those moments too, where it clicked of like, shoot, they should beat me 10 times out of 10, but you know what? People screw up and I'm going to put myself in a position all the time to be there to pick up the pieces that they screw up.
Yeah. You've done it actually a really good job with that. What was one of the biggest learning points you had to go from high school, from college, not from high school, but from college to the pros? Was that it? Of like, I mean, actually come looking at it, you're like, well, I'm just going to go beat anybody that's in front of me, no matter the line, the wind, or whatever pace we're going. But what was one of the biggest things you had to learn from college to the pros?
Well, I guess I'll turn that question a little bit. One of the best pieces of advice that helped me avoid failure was my high school coach told me, get ready to get your butt kicked. And so I went in just expecting the worst, and literally almost every day for the first month I got dropped, and I was okay with it. Like I didn't like it, but I it didn't make me hit the panic button. I was just like, all right, well, this is supposed to happen. And at some point I'll be able to hang with them. And in my time at Wisconsin, at least, we had some really, really talented people come through while I was there. And there was quite a few people who fell through the cracks. And I think it was because, you know, we were pretty dang good. And you're going to come in and you're going to think you're really good and you're going to get your teeth kicked in. And if you're not ready for that, that could totally deflate you and derail you. And I, like, to me, I am so thankful for Don Behnke for saying that to me, because if he hadn't, like, I had a big enough ego at the time that it could have crushed it. And, you know, it got to the point where, like, I learned how to hang and I learned how to run more relaxed. I learned how to take care of myself. I learned how to just recover in between. And up until, I still am mad at Jerry, up until the last 1200 meters of our last tempo run that freshman year, I was the only guy to finish every workout, because I went down and ran with the guys in the summer. And like that whole summer was drop fest after drop fest, but got to the point where I could hang. And yeah, I was one of the only guys to actually get through all the workouts. And then Jerry pulled me the last 1200 and last tempo, and I fought tooth and nail to have him keep me in, but he wouldn't.
So I think you bring up a really interesting point here. And, you know, I think when anybody's at the peak level of any profession, they're a master of it. You know, people always like say, you know, you set American record, you break a world record, and people just say, oh man, they're so talented, right? They're so talented. And they truly never see the blood, sweat, and tears, mm-hmm. and the overcome, like how you've overcome setbacks and disappointments and that fear of failure, like you spoke earlier. I mean, I think that's what makes the greats truly great, is that they keep coming back. And they can shed all that negativity and just like, you know what, I know myself, I know what my goals are, and they just keep moving forward. So yeah, I'm just wondering if you see the same thing at the highest level as a coach and as an athlete.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think inherently competitors are competitors, right? So, you know, even when we're going through the recruiting process, like I would take a kid all day, every day, that's consistently top two or three, maybe running a little bit slower than somebody who is buried but running really, really great times. Because at the end of the day, that kid who's running great times at buried has never learned how to compete. And they've never figured out how to find a way to be the cream that rises to the top. And, you know, for us, we're about that competitor, because you, at least here, like, I'm in an amazing situation, working with an amazing staff. Coach Holloway is an amazing head coach and boss. And one of the things I've learned here, some people have the button and some people don't. And the button is, when game time comes, you know you can count on them. They're going to give you that performance. They're going to step up to the plate. And maybe they have a bad day, but you know what? They know the people behind them are going to get the job done as well, because all of those people share the same sentiment, same type of preparation. And we always have a back and forth of like, is that something that can be taught, or is that just natural? And, you know, for me, I believe that there's a little bit of both. I think you can teach it, but I believe that there's a lot of people out there that just naturally have that performer. And for me, to be perfectly honest, like going back to, you know, we sit around and talk philosophy all the time. One of the things that we talked about, and you know, for me, for example, like I hated training, hated it, despised it, knew I had to do it to get better, and found a way to love it so that I could get better and not hate every second of every day. But you know what, when I showed up to a race, I turned into a peacock. I wanted everyone to see me. I wanted everyone to see all the hard work that I put in. And it wasn't necessarily, I think a lot of people, if they haven't figured out how to compete, they show up to a meet and say, I got to do all this. I got to work harder. I got to do more to have this great performance, have this great outcome, and make all the training worth it. And they put this pressure on themselves that, you know, just dampens and gets in the way of everything. And versus the people that then show up and say, this is the fruits of all my labor. Like, I'm just going to go and I'm going to show everybody what I'm doing. I'm going to just do the same things I'm doing. But you know what? I'm going to get jacked up because I got some adrenaline. I'm wearing jersey. I'm wearing spikes. Like, I'm in a great place and the lights are on. Let's perform. And I think those are the people that you see time and time again have those big performances and be the cream that rises to the top. And I think it comes down to just that competitive instinct. But I do believe that it's teachable, but it takes a lot longer. And those are the ones you see maybe kind of muddling in the weeds until you get to junior, senior year, that those are the ones that were taught it. The ones that you see coming out the box, like, you know, Grant Holloway, like, that guy competes at every little thing he does. And it shows. And he is a performer. He is a gamer. And that's why he has that button, you know, because he just loves to show it.
And, you know, I totally agree. And I think being surrounded with like-minded people also, you know, when you talk about teaching it, I think they can learn that indirectly by seeing those people that inherently have it, you know, shed those failures, get over it, get back to the grind and stick their nose back in there the next time. So yeah, that's a good point.
Speaking more on that failure piece, like, to being a peacock and a performer, you got to be able to take your lumps. Like, I had some really, really ugly races, really ugly races. People don't remember those, but I sure do. And I learned more from those races than I did from the ones that went well. And, you know, I had some that made me question why I do this. But ultimately, like, taking a step back and figuring out, like, hey, what are the things that I can control and what are the things that I can't? And the things I can control, great, I'm going to do those better. Things I can't, forget about it. It's in the rearview mirror. And, you know, I just think it's unrealistic, and maybe it's because of the day and age we're in with the social media. It's getting worse and worse. Like, everybody's connected, and, you know, internet message boards and all that stuff, where people just see success. They don't see the failure. So if they have one failure, they're like, I'm never going to make it. And it's like, well, that's part of the process. And, you know, for us, like, I try to disengage so much with result and what we talk about times, we talk about what we're preparing for, right? But, like, what we talk about more is, how do we get there? What are the things we need to do in execution to be able to get that performance? And I never talk about splits, never. I hate talking about splits when it comes to races. And I'd rather say, okay, this is maybe, if I talk about splits at all, like, it'll probably be around here, here or there for a split, just so you're kind of mentally can prepare, but, like, these are the positions we want to be in. These are the places people want to run with. Now get there and win that race. And it might change. Like, maybe you have a day where it's not your best day. So find a different race to win. And for us, like, we're big on building that culture, and it wasn't great when I got here. And we're certainly building strong, but I believe big time, like you said, it's the people you have around you, because it's a family. Like, you need people to pick you up when you're down, because it's going to happen. You need people to be able to celebrate with when it goes well, and you need people to get through the process with you and help push you, because if you're in a part of a great group, you contribute to that group gets better, and the group contributes to you and gets you better. Nobody shines alone. It's always through a group.
You know, it's pretty clear that you've been a part of some really high level programs and high level coaching situations. Was this you getting into coaching post running always part of the plan, or was that something that sort of organically happened? I'm curious what that process looked like for you.
I actually wanted to coach from the jump. So I was very, very fortunate. I think, Matt, you know, you've met Coach Banky, Don Banky.
Oh, many a times. Incredible, incredible gentleman.
Yeah, this man, we had over 100 boys alone on our cross country team, and he had a way of connecting with every single one of them, inspiring, motivating, making a big difference in their lives. And so, like, from the start, like, that inspired me. And he was a history teacher and cross country coach, and that's what I went to school for. I'm like, all right, I'm going to teach and coach. And then, you know, being in the collegiate system and seeing Schumacher, I'm like, wow, I could be a coach and not have to teach as much. Little did I know there's much more teaching than there is coaching, but truth. You know, it's that idea. I was like, man, this is awesome. Like, this is okay. This is what I want to do. And then, you know, I was just really fortunate that you know, my own running got in the way for a while and kind of put that on pause. But you better believe I was a student everywhere I went and everyone I interacted with. And I was that guy, like, you're on a European circuit and there's, you know, you're at the hotels and they provide meals and you sit around and talk. Like, if I didn't have a notepad, but I was like, ooh, I got to remember that. I got to remember that. And I'd get back to the room and be like, okay, I got to write that down. But like, I was always just trying to be as much of a sponge as I could. And I wish I retained more of it, because that's the breeding ground of greatness. And, you know, there's a lot of things that people do, you're like, you're crazy. But there's a lot of things that people are doing that's like, okay, it's not that hard. Like, referencing, you know, Magnus's tweet of like, great coaches make complex things simple and bad coaches make simple things complex. Like, it makes our job sound bad, but like, it's not that hard. it's the hardest part is making sure we're teaching the kids. And, you know, we always talk here about growing grown people. Like, that's the hard part, but that's the most rewarding part of it.
Well, I'd like to ask you about, you know, you mentioned when you were at Wisconsin, you had some people that were really talented, and Wisconsin was a program that brought in a lot of talent, but some of them fell through the cracks. At Florida, you know, you're an apex school and you bring in a lot of talent. How do you deal, you know, maybe speak directly to some of the coaches, how do you deal with some of those kids that you see falling through the cracks? How do you try to bring them out of the cracks, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, the reality is we try to relate our experiences, because, I mean, you look at a lot of the coaches that we have on staff are from really great programs that they probably have a lot of the similar stories that I had at Wisconsin. And, you know, we just try to relate our own experiences. But yeah, I mean, you see kids going down this path, and like, that's also what's great about our staff and our program is like, I'll talk to jumpers, I'll talk to sprinters, I'll talk to throwers, and all those coaches will talk to my kids. And if you see somebody kind of going down that path, you're like, hey, like, this is part of it. This, you know, don't hang your hat. Like, you came, like, remember where you are. If you're getting your butt kicked here, like, you're still doing pretty dang well. And, you know, you're still going to have kids where, like, they might do better at a smaller school than a place like Florida, that being able to be successful in practice leads to confidence that leads to races. And then there's going to be the kids that still do well, and maybe it takes them a year or two to figure it out. And with those kids, like, for me anyway, I just try to be really honest with them of like, look, my expectations aren't that you come into the door blowing people's doors off. Like, come in, learn, get your butt kicked for a little while, figure out how the people that are kicking your butt, how they got there, and learn from them, because I see it in you. And if I see it in you, like, you should see it in you, but be patient with it. So I think the big part is just honesty. And sometimes those conversations are hard and awkward, but I've learned to be okay with it. Cause at first I was like, ugh, I don't want to have this conversation, but all right. But I think the kids will gain trust, and they, you know, they'll buy into things a lot more. And coach always makes fun of me cause I talk too much. He says I need to talk a little less, but like, I'm big on like, I want it under people to understand the whys and the hows. And if they do, maybe they're going to increase their buy-in just that much more. And we'll get just a little bit more out of them. And hopefully a love for the sport and a love for their team that goes beyond their 4 or 5 years here.
Yeah. I mean, one of our assistant coaches that works with me at VCU, Ethan Tucson, he was a volunteer down at Florida, and, you know, he talks all about Coach Holloway and the culture that he's built. And, you know, that's well before your time being down there, and just to see that kind of continued success, you know, and to see how you're fitting into it now and what you're doing with your guys and your young ladies, you know, it's encouraging to see. And for all the young coaches out there, I would just encourage them to, you know, try to build that culture of success, and you'll start seeing people come in and improve.
Well, I think Walt said something last week, where, you know, it's about the kid. It's not about us. And, you know, I was very fortunate that the person that I looked up to as a coach was Schumacher, and that guy couldn't have been more about the kid and not about him because that guy, you can't catch him on a camera or can't catch him to get interviewed. Like, he could care less if he's getting the accolades. Like, he doesn't want to be talked about. And so that was kind of my model that I shaped myself after. And you know, Kotalo is similar. Like, it's getting, you want to see the athletes run well, but the athletes are going to run better if they know that you actually care about them. If they know that, you know, you're, if we're putting down a culture and it's a sustainable, it's a healthy culture, these kids are going to run through brick walls for you. And for me, like, you know, a lot of young coaches, and like you see it, and I consider myself still a young coach because I'm young in coaching years, but like, there's a lot of young coaches that are just bouncing. And I mean, you're not trying to build a culture. You're just trying to build your name for the next opportunity. The next show. And like, the idea of like being okay wherever you are and build a culture, like, even if that isn't where you necessarily see yourself, it's going to be your best success rather than trying to take shortcuts, and you're not going to have the trust. You're not going to have the results that you want. Like, it actually backfires.
Yeah. It takes buy-in both ways.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's great advice. I think I always call it digging your heels in. Mm-hmm. wherever you're at, you know, dig your heels in, create the culture, build something. And then whatever opportunity presents itself, you know, later on down the road could be the right one. Yeah. But don't get caught up in that, oh, you know, the grass is greener type thing, because it, like you said, you're going to end up chasing. The result isn't going to be nearly as good. And, yeah. So I totally agree with that and feel that.
It's something I know. I'll speak to it in briefly, but every time I've looked at somebody who's jumped from place for a year, they're at one place for a year, and then they jump for another place for a year, and they do it 3 or 4 jobs in a row, and then finally they dig their heels in. I was like, so what didn't you like before? Because you obviously were chasing something else, but is that something that you are in general? You're just chasing that bigger job, and if you do well for a couple of years, you're going to jump quickly. What do you teach the kids? You can't do that. You know, you have to have a rhyme and reason to do it, and that rhyme and reason changes every year. It should change. It's got to tweak, and it's got to change with the kids you have. It shouldn't tweak a lot, because even Walt said it last week. He's like, you don't have to change things much. You just got to just change it just a little bit every single year, because your teams are going to be just a little bit different. That culture is going to be a little bit different, and expectations are going to be a little bit different as well. There's nothing there. apologize. Wow. Excuse me. Drinks going down the wrong throat. That kind of stuff can happen, you know, especially in a podcast. So I love it. We're getting into some incredible coaching things real quick. But one thing I want to ask, just because, have you had a memorable moment as an athlete, as a pro, as a college coach? Is there one that is like, yes, this was kind of my memorable one?
To be honest, like, the things that are running through my head more than anything are things with the team. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously, you know, winning the national title in cross country in 2005 after finishing second forever before that.
Yeah, many times.
Was a huge, more of a relief than anything else, because, you know, for us, like, we just felt like we choked every single time. And to finally put the pieces together and put it together in such a special way was memorable. And then, you know, in 2007, winning the indoor national title. And, you know, for me, that was actually really special, because cross country the fall before, like, was abysmal. You know, I had an awful race, cost our team a title, because I was being selfish. You know, I was kind of sick going into that race, and Jerry and I talked about a strategy that we think would have set us up for a strong team performance. And I'm gonna throw my dad under the bus here a little bit, but after the meeting I had with Schumacher, coming up with the, like, shooting for top 10 versus shoot for title, because being the top returner from the year before, like, you know, all eyes were on me of trying to win the title. And so we were like, okay, just do what we need to do to be top 10. Let's get the team points and survive to fight another day. And I was like, yeah, that, I can do that. Let's do that. So then I meet with my dad the night before, and he's like, you know what, you've run for this team for 3 years and sacrificed for this team for 3 years. He's like, it's time to run for you. I'm like, you're right. I'm going to go for that title. And God, worst decision that I ever made. ended up finishing 73rd. So I was pissed. And that was one of those times where I fell down three times in the final stretch. I actually had a kid, not a kid. It happened two of the three times I fell. Somebody came by and yelled like, "Come on, Chris, I used to look up to you." And I'm like, "Wow, talk about kicking you when you're down." I'm like, "I used to look up to you. Thanks." but that was one of those moments where like, I questioned why am I doing this? Like, that wasn't fun. I didn't enjoy that. Like, I'm doing all of this and I felt like I made all the decisions, the right decisions, and did all the right things that fall and still got sick and it got screwed up. And like, I probably took a month off of running and questioned if I was going to do it again. And finally settled on like, okay, why did you get into running? You got into running because you love it and you love competing. Remember that and hold on to that. And if you do that, like, you're going to have success. And so that was kind of my mantra the rest of the year. And I remember coming back to school after winter break and sitting down with Nutty and Schumacher and being like, okay, what do we have to do to win? Because we had Demi O'Malley, one of the best, you know, short sprinters in the country. We had Joe Thomas, one of the best throwers in the country. Joe Detmer was one of the, best multi-eventers in the country. Alonzo Moore, one of the better triple jumpers. Obviously we had, a plethora of distance crew and, so I was like, what do you need from me? Tell me what I need to do and we're going to do it. We're going to win a national title and it worked. and so that was a real memorable one because it's kind of a comeback for me. I got a couple more, but I don't want to bore you. all of them revolve around like doing it with people. And that's kind of what I always tell the kids that I work with. Like, look, you only have 4, maybe 5 years left when we start like to do put something together special as a team, and I'm telling you, having been through it and having done it, and I've done some special things alone, that does not ever stack up to what you do collectively, overcoming odds and doing things as a group and as a team. And like, let's get better as a group and better as a team that are going to allow you to do some special things as an individual too. So yeah, those are the best ones.
I think those are the best ones you can actually learn from, and you can tell your kids are going to learn an absolute ton from you. I think, although if I'm not mistaken, the 4 to 5 years you're talking about being in college, actually, no, my coach would tell you that. No. The 4 to 5 years to being in college, that's to make me famous. What are you talking about? Come on now. I'm driving the Chevy right now. I need to be able to drive the Beamer or the Lexus when I'm done. Like, no, he was joking. It was all about the team. The best moments, absolutely, when we won the regional. And we were unexpected to win the regional. I was like, yeah, that was a moment I'll never forget. Like, I don't care what happened after that. Like, I winning that regional, being fifth, like, yeah, let's go. Let's bring that stuff. And you have the experiences, you have the, you've had the failures, you've had everything in between, and you've had the epic failures. You said it. So your kids are going to learn a heck of a lot from you. But when you get into it, you get out of the, you're in the world of the pro world, and then you've seen the collegiate world now. I mean, you've been at what, Portland, William & Mary as well. Now you're down to Florida, rock and rolling. What is something, because you can look at the sport from a lot of different viewpoints. What is something in the sport you go, dude, college world, wake up. We got to do this because we're relevant, or we're not relevant. Or, hey, as we talked about earlier in the start of the podcast, the American Track League is exactly what we need. And maybe John Bell can bring in something here that I know that they're working on in the executive committee. We're going to let it go a little bit. We're going to open that can of worms a little bit because I just did. But Chris, what is there something that we need to change? I mean, I know we're very opinionated guys. If there's something we need to change or something we need to do, is it, hey, you know what? I think one of the things we talked about before, get off your egos. Screw with the egos of like, oh my goodness, I don't think my team's going to be good enough. UAB versus SLU, I don't know if we're going to be good enough. Maybe we shouldn't go up against it. Maybe I shouldn't run my top kids or this. Maybe the sprinters shouldn't do this. Like, get out of the comfort zone. What do you think that would help change the collegiate world? And we're not even going to worry about the pro world, because just being a small group of, it's actually being a group of collegiate coaches. Let's just stick to that world a little bit. If you wanted to go, we can, but let's stick in that.
I mean, it boils down to one major thing is compete. We've gotten into I don't mean to keep referring to Walt. I mean, the man's a legend, and the podcast last week was great. So like, he talked about like the big invites, right? Like the big long invites. Nobody other than parents, us as coaches and the kids that we coach care about that. So if we want to be taken seriously from administrators, we want to be taken seriously by the public, by fans, create fans, we have to compete, and we have to compete in ways that people understand. Even, I mean, Matt, you and I had conversations this summer about like the hot topic of regional qualifying. Like,
yep.
And there's a lot of people out there that believe that, okay, we're cross country is a different sport and we can't be put in the box of other sports. Why not? Because it's not how we've done it, and you don't have it figured out right now. Well, us coaches are pretty dang smart. We can figure it out. I think a lot of coaches around the country have figured out how to handle all the adversities and hurdles and obstacles that COVID has thrown at us, and how, you know, even just like within the SEC, like we pitched there was an idea of, we're going to have an East versus West. So like there's going to be an SEC East and SEC West. You compete against East teams, or if you're in the East, you compete against West teams. If you're in the West, you come together. We have an event specialist weekend where everyone kind of blends, but it's just the event groups. And then that's how you hit your qualifiers, and whether it's the SEC meet or to the NCAA meet, and then you have your conference championship. Like, those are great ideas. And again, like, COVID in the last like 10, 12 months has been unbelievable for forcing us to think outside the box. It is really easy to keep doing what we've been doing. It's really easy. Every coach here knows how to figure out how to get your kid in the top 48. You know, you get it done, you can get in the top 40 in the region, and then, okay, let's get it done on that day and be in the top 12. If you have the caliber of kids, you figured out how to get into the top 16 for indoors. Like, we figured out how to qualify in the system now, and it's just because we're uncomfortable thinking of different systems. And I think, to be perfect, my opinion, whether my opinion is a valid one or not, is we have to be starting to think, okay, how would an administrator think? Like, how are we going to be taken seriously and add validity to our sport? Like, it might have to ruffle a few feathers of people that, like, yeah, I got it figured out. Like, especially the coaches who have it and are really, really successful and like just don't want to have to try to figure it out because they got the mold and they year in, year out, they churn out what they need. Like, yeah, of course, like if I was in their shoes, I wouldn't want to, but if, you know, the coach Holloway, the man I work for, he has a saying and I 100% believe in it. You tell me how to do it, I'm going to figure out how to do it. I'm going to figure out how to be great within the confines of those rules. And so I battle myself because I believe that. But I'm also somebody that wants to see our sport be successful. And so like, sometimes I'm like, I'll just wait on the sidelines and you tell me how to do it, I'll figure out how to do it. But then the other side is like, I want our sport to be taken seriously. I want our sport to, you know, right now, like obviously our sports are ones that are being considered on chopping blocks. And so how do we add credence and validity? I think, you know, dual meets, tri meets, quad meets, you compete. Let's, you know, people are still running fast times in small meets right now. We don't need these big mega meets to hit marks, you know, and it's obviously I'm a distance runner and a distance coach. So like, I think times, but like people are still getting together and making sure that there's good, you know, people are jumping far, people are jumping high, people are throwing far. Like we're going to be creative and get it done for what we need to get done. And we're forced to do it in unconventional ways.
You know, when you're thinking,
Go ahead. No, Mike.
Oh, yeah. I was just going to say, when you're thinking about marks, I mean, it's one thing to have a particular number in your head that you're trying to achieve at those big meets. But I think that those big marks come as a byproduct from trying to compete to beat somebody, right? So we're so concerned that if we don't have these perfect conditions that are set up with just the right people on just the right track on just the right day, that we're not going to be able to achieve these certain marks. Well, shoot, I think we're almost giving some of those kids too much credit. It's like, you know, they got that kind of figured out, but you line them up against somebody where they've got to go to the well to be able to just to beat somebody or to compete with somebody. I don't even suspicion. I promise you, you're going to get those same, if not better results from a lesser renowned meet just because, hey, listen, if I beat this guy, our team wins this meet, or we, you know what I mean? We carry this trophy around the track at the end of the day. We're going to get those marks. And man, that's a way more exciting way to watch something happen than, you know, a guy just running by himself or a woman just running by herself, you know, because they're on pace to meet a certain time or whatever, you know, and you create some energy and some culture and some consequences for winning and losing. And, you know, you aren't the first person we've had on here that everybody said the same thing. Dual meets, tri meets, quad meets, let's compete. And I got to think that there's sort of an undercurrent of people who we don't hear from a lot at things like conventions or public gatherings of track coaches who would agree. And it is those guys, without, you know, we're not saying names here necessarily, but it is those guys who are perennially in contention for national titles. They're the ones that don't want to see the change. And like you said, why would they? Because they've got this figured out. Why do I want to make it more difficult for me to keep winning national titles? I don't want to do that. Now, because what I do is I give everybody else in the world, if they can figure out how to game this system before I can figure out how to game this new system, then maybe I don't get to sit at the top of the heap anymore, you know? And, but it's good to hear, you know, person after person after person. I think if, you know, there's a, like I said, a very strong undercurrent of people who would be more than happy to go out and have winners and losers on the weekend and find out what you are. Maybe you don't win this weekend. So what, right? Like, we're going to go toe to toe and we're going to find out, and we're getting some really exciting, some big marks out of that. And yeah, I think you were going to, I don't want to steal your thunder there, Matt, of the transition into what John's got, but I think there might be something somewhat like that. I don't know.
You weren't stealing the thunder at all. 100%. I agree with you. I think, what do we had 33, 34 podcasts, something like that. And of the people that have been on here talking about this, I think all but three have actually commented on it, because we've asked all but three on there. And they've all said the exact same thing. Like, let's go ahead and do this. And you're right. I think you might be, can you sit down at the convention, Herb? You sit down those things, you watch those. The ones that don't want to change much are the ones that have the biggest skin in the game for the most part. Mm-hmm. And again, some of those are all for changing. Some of the coaches are all for changing, but most are, okay, this is it. This is the system. This is how we do things. Here's what it is. And guess what? I know I get here, I'm going to get my bonuses. Boom, I'm out the door. I got this. We won a title. We're out and off we go. But we create more things like actually, Chris, I love that idea with the SEC setting East versus the West and then going event specialist weekend and going off there. I think that's awesome. And I think John and his exec committee, I'm going to open the door for him. Went ahead and decided to start looking at this kind of stuff. And John, if you get in trouble for this, Sam can call me up and, you know, we'll talk to him.
He'll probably call me up and yell. But no, a couple things, you know, Chris, as you were talking there, I kind of just dawned on me. And I've said this before in previous episodes. I truly don't like blaming coaches, you know, for all our problems. I don't think that's a good practice to be in, because, you know, I don't want to blame us for every problem. But you want to talk about hypocrisy. You know, we just got done talking, or Chris, you just got done talking a little bit about, you know, taking chances, right? And putting yourself out there and competing and it's how many coaches in this country say that to all their kids week in and week out? Hey, put yourself in this race, put your nose in it, take a chance, you know, don't be afraid of failure. And then when we sit here and talk about changing the national championships or changing our schedule, we're the first one to to back out because we're afraid of change. Like, the hypocrisy is, you know, astounding to me, and I'm probably going to get a bunch of hate mail this week because of it, but, you know, so be it. I've said it, and I we have to address it, right? I mean, there's, how do we not address that hypocrisy? If we're going to sit here and tell kids, take chances and put yourself out there, yet we're not willing to do it ourselves, that's a problem. That's just John Bell's own personal opinion there. But no, we, you know, and this isn't really, secret news. You know, there was an email from the Coaches Association that went out, you know, in I think it was early November. We had planned having a head coaches, or at least, you know, one representative from every Division I institution, a summit in Atlanta. Obviously, you know, COVID numbers went in a direction where that wasn't, you know, feasible. And again, rightly so. And you know, Sam Seams, our the CEO of our Coaches Association, made the call on that. And it was definitely the right call. You know, we don't want to get, you know, coaches sick, or, you know, put them in a precarious position with, you know, themselves, their families, and their loved ones. So, you know, it was definitely the right call. But, you know, the idea of this, and we've talked about it, you know, as a member of the Division I Executive Committee, and we've talked about, you know, obviously numerous times on this podcast, is you know, one of the things COVID has done is it's shown a spotlight on our sport and really on a bigger level, the, you know, intercollegiate athletics and what, you know, kind of where we sit at all of our individual institutions and the value we bring as an entity, intercollegiate athletics, and then obviously specifically cross country and track and field. And the idea was we wanted to get Division One together, put them all in a room and actually have a conversation of, listen, you know, the world has changed. You know, every industry has changed because of COVID. Ours isn't immune to that. What are some things that we need to do here and now to help keep our sport viable, to improve our sport, to enhance our sport, to enhance the opportunities for the you know, the athletes that we coach? You know, so that's where this, the idea of the coaches summit came to be. And, obviously, like I said, it got canceled, but you know, those conversations have continued, at the executive committee level, and we're going to tackle some issues. And, you know, eventually we're going to, you know, one of the challenges that has been, you know, posed to us is, finding a time, in 2021 to have a summit of Division One. Of Division One coaches to have an in-person conversation. So that will happen when, you know, from a public health standpoint, when it's viable. But in the meantime, you know, every conference is represented on the, you know, the Division One executive committee. We're all peer, you know, elected from our, you know, our peers in our conference. So we've decided as an executive committee to have some of those conversations. And at least to not create an agenda, because as I said, you know, I was fortunate, David Schuhalter, the president of Division One, assigned me as the kind of chair of a working group to come up with some of these talking points. And as I told the executive committee in our last call, I didn't want this, you know, I didn't want the summit to be the John Bell agenda of how we move track and field forward. I didn't feel that was fair. It has to be a grassroots, you know, I feel it has to be a grassroots, you know, effort amongst all the coaches. But one of the things, you know, I know I'm getting long-winded here, but, you know, one of the things we just recently talked about was conference engagement. How do we engage with all of our respective conferences in the scheduling component of track and field? And, you know, I think there's obviously it's an unvetted idea right now, but I think there's a lot of opportunities. And Chris, you kind of alluded to this in what you were saying just, you know, a few minutes ago. And Mike, you've talked about this in episode after episode about, you know, having smaller meets, but what is wrong with being like basketball? What is wrong with being, you know, like the soccer programs or, you know, the baseball programs or football or some of these other programs in this respect of, you know, maybe the conference offices need to schedule some of our meets. You know, have some interconference competition, because again, you know, last, you know, just what was it? 4 days ago, you know, 5 days ago, Oregon set the collegiate record in the DMR. And, you know, how many teams were on the track? Two other teams besides them. So clearly you can run fast, in smaller meets. And so if all of a sudden conferences started to, you know, I know there's financial concerns. Clearly there's going to be financial concerns for especially some of the mid-major, group of five, super 22, whatever we call ourselves. You know, some of these leagues that have, you know, institutions spread out all over the country, and how do you get to, you know, how do you make this work? But again, you know, because that was my knee-jerk reaction. It's like, gosh, if I have to, you know, we're in the Atlantic 10 conference and, you know, University of Rhode Island, that's the school I use as the example, is a long way from us. You know, if I went to my AD as it stands right now and said, hey, I want to have a dual meet with Rhode Island. He's going to look at me and say, you don't have the budget for that, which we don't. But if all of a sudden the conference office comes in and says, your track team is going to have a dual meet with Rhode Island, I don't say magically, but our AD is going to find the money pretty quickly for that track meet. You know, because they do it with baseball, they do it with soccer, they do it with basketball, they do it with women's basketball, they do it with all the other sports. So, you know, how we get to that, I don't know, but I think it's an avenue, that is definitely worth exploring. I think, you know, having your national qualifiers come from those meets again, because the performances are outstanding. And so I feel like, hey, if we come up with a system where we can have some smaller meets to engage fans, to engage our campus community, that still produce national qualifying marks, I don't see that as a loss. I think that's only a benefit. And the other thing that is really interesting, because we had this conversation back when we had the Dartmouth staff on the, you know, as an episode, yep. When we start talking about rivalries, you know, Ohio State, Michigan, right? Florida, Tennessee, you start to have some of those type of, you know, SLU and Dayton. I mean, that's a real barn burner these days, right? you start to have, but obviously UCLA and USC already has, has a big meet, but you start to bring into some of those traditional rivalries. I fail to see where that's bad for the sport of track and field.
People go to that. People want to watch that.
People want to watch that. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's some, and again, and I said this on a call, because again, we've talked about it a lot on this podcast. Everybody says, hey, we need to have smaller meets. We need to have scored meets. But then I get on TFERS, right? If I got on TFERS right now and looked at all the track meets that took place this last weekend, how many meets were actually scored? Very, very few. There were some, but very few were actually scored. And so, again, it's almost this, hypocrisy of, everybody will say, well, we need scored meets. We need smaller meets. Well, we have smaller meets because of COVID. Everything's kind of more regional. And, we need to score meets. Well, then why aren't we scoring meets? Like, I guess I'll put it out there. And again, I'm going to get some hate mail, I think, this week. But why aren't we scoring meets? For all these coaches that say we need to score meets, start scoring the damn meets. It's.
We got back. I will say one more thing.
I'll say, and I understand why people don't, is because right now there's no value to it. Right? Who cares if you win or lose a track meet right now? Because there's nothing tied to winning or losing. I was just as you were talking, I was our men's basketball team was playing LaSalle tonight, and unfortunately it looks like we're going to lose. That's a big loss for us. It's a big deal, and I know our basketball kids and our basketball coaches, I'm assuming we're down by 7 with 21 seconds left. So unless there was a miracle,
Reggie Miller.
Yeah. Unless Reggie Miller showed up. Yeah. we're probably losing that game. That is a major loss for us. We were picked to finish 2nd in the league. We were ranked 22nd in the nation 2 weeks ago, and we lost to LaSalle. But our basketball staff, our basketball coach is the highest paid coach in our department for a reason. And he's going to be feeling this loss. And as track coaches, if we want to make the big money and we want to put ourselves out there, we have to put something on the line. So I know I'm off my soapbox now.
I think you're right. I think you hit something though, right there at the end. The biggest thing you hit was right there at the end I walked back. We got back from the meet from Clemson this weekend, and I ran to our team doctor. Our team doctor goes, because he was coming across the street from a volleyball match, and he's like, "I'm like, well, how volleyball do?" They're like, "Oh, they won their first set, I think, against Lipscomb or whoever it was," and so it was awesome. Congrats to Coach Freeberg for her first win in the UAB uniform. And she, and he's like, "How'd the team do?" And I was like, "I actually was at a loss for words because I didn't have an answer for him. I couldn't tell him. I don't know how we did. I was like, our 4x4 ran great, our 400 runners grand great, blah blah blah. I don't have a team score for you." And he's like, "Oh, well, you guys handled X and Y and Z, which I can't talk about in there, but X, Y, and Z properly. So thank you for doing that." I was like, awesome. Appreciate that. But I couldn't tell him anything like that. I think we can change scores. And you're right. It doesn't matter. Florida versus UAB, it doesn't matter. Let's go ahead and do a dual meet. We'll get our asses kicked, but it won't matter because congratulations, you guys won the meet, but there's no team score.
That's why people can't relate
at all. Yeah.
I think that's why the common person can't relate. And like we talked about earlier, I don't care what sport it is. I don't care if it's swimming and diving. I don't care what it is, bowling. If it's Ohio State, Michigan, people are going to be interested.
But,
they could not even be interested in that particular sport. But people that are truly passionate about the university and the athletics program, they're going to have an interest.
But the big thing that we can have dual scores and all that stuff. But here's what it sits down and comes down to is, hey, Florida, you beat UAB or whatever. Okay, fine. Awesome. You beat us. What does it mean? What does that mean? Oh, it doesn't mean anything. Florida beat UAB. Oh, UAB beat Florida. Okay. What does it mean? It means nothing. Okay. UAB lost to Indiana. What does that mean? It means nothing. So you have to have some sort of system that it does come up with. Does the East versus West system in the SEC, is that something that would work? And which, hey, you have these, like, how does that help us qualify to the national meet? How does that help us qualify to a conference championship, a four-team conference championship, or maybe a six-team conference championship? Is that something where I can sit down and say, just because of a conference school here, you know, we beat FAU and FIU. Okay, UAB beat those two schools. Boom, perfect. That means that we get X amount of points, or we get, I don't know, I'm just spitballing, but six qualifiers to the championships. At least we have something. I know it sounds crazy, but do we have something that can help us push the sport forward? Because we can score meets all we want. We can put them in the paper all we want. But we know, John, just as you said, SLU basketball loses to, is probably going to lose to LaSalle. And maybe when you open this up on Sunday, they lost to LaSalle. Okay. We know what that means. We know what that hits. We know where that hit the rankings. We know that hits the standings, how it does everything. It doesn't matter what we do. And John, you and Tom here in the same conference, it doesn't matter if you guys go lose to VCU every single weekend. What does it do towards national qualifying? Nothing. So if we do change this, I think we have to strip it down to all the way back down to the bare bones, to the skeleton, and say, we need to go from the ground up and completely rework it. But you need a bunch of coaches that are willing to say, you know what, this is going to suck for a couple of years because we may get our asses kicked, but this is going to be, in the end of it, better for the sport.
You know, there's a couple things. You know, at the end of the day, you have to put value on winning, right?
Yes.
And I've talked about, you know, athletics, you know, because we've had multiple conversations on this podcast of the value of intercollegiate athletics. And I think there's obviously the educational co-curricular aspect of athletics. And I would say track and field is really good at that. You know, whatever form we take, we're going to be really, really good at that. I think just the nature of our sport lends itself to educating young people and dealing with success, dealing with failure, setting goals. Like, inherently, I think we're going to always do really, really well with that. But we're also about competition, right? Division I athletics, there is an element of Division I that is rooted in competition. So I think you have to get back to who won or lost. That is critical. That's critical to what we do. And as we somehow we have to get back to that. And not that, you know, I don't want to say, you know, that maybe the high level Power Five that they forgot, you know, I think that's always there, but, you know, I think across all of Division I, we have to get back to winning. That is a really critical piece to what we do.
Yeah, absolutely. I got to say, we could probably keep going on this for a lot longer if we wanted to, just a matter of how late in the end of the night we want to get rocking and rolling, but, strip it down, change the whole system. Let's go for it. Let's see what happens, guys. We got 6-7 of us. Let's put a proposal together and make the thing completely change. No, in all honesty, Chris, it is awesome. It's an honor to absolutely have you here on the podcast, on the Off Track podcast. It was great having you here to pull a chair up and to talk about it. And there's no questions about it. Listening to your stories, listening to the successes, the failures, what you've learned, the fact that you're probably one of those guys that, A, we're reading a ton, and B, has a notebook right by the side of his bed because he's popping up in the middle of the night writing something down.
You know. You got me down.
But it works, and it loves it. And you can tell that, you know, no matter be the Florida or whenever, you know, maybe whenever Mick Byrne decides to step aside, you take over the Wisconsin program, you know. But in all honesty, you can tell how successful you're going to be just because of the passion that you have for it. So that is incredible. So thank you for joining us here tonight.
No, thanks for having me, and I apologize. I say this to everyone, I ramble a lot, so I apologize for the breathless rambles.
No, I mean, you don't ramble that much. Just all you got to do is listen to John Bell and see how much rambling actually goes on. So
I ramble.
But all right, gentlemen, we will definitely talk to you again next week. Thanks for joining us, everybody.
Thanks, Chris.
Thank you, guys.
Well, I tell you what, man, the intensity and passion that Chris has for running and coaching, it's infectious. And I love how, whether the situation, whatever situation his athlete's in, they're going to fight. But he learned that. But I mean, I think those athletes can absolutely tell that from the situations he was in as an athlete, and where he threw down and said, I don't care if we're going for world records or not, we are going after that race. And if I may fall on my face, but you know what, we're going for it. So that was absolutely incredible.
one of the greatest things I think that Chris referenced in there is you have to stay true to yourself, have to stay true to your guts, have to stay true to the plan. That's one thing he always did. He never veered from it. And the one time he did, it definitely bit him in the butt at the NCAA championships, which he talked about. So it was great to hear him be open and honest about that. But as always, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for making us one of the top ranked podcasts in the country. Thank you for your continued support, your continued sharing of the podcast, the Off Track Podcast. It is great to have you here each and every week. We know that you have a lot of different podcasts to choose from, and we appreciate you choosing this. So, and if you would, as always, please share, retweet, post, whatever you'd like to do with the podcast. If you have ideas and questions, please email me, email any of the guys on the table, and we will sit down and take a look at them, see if it's worthwhile. But we look forward to doing an even better job for you next week. Thank you.